Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, a journey into mystery and a gateway to the mind of nature and the nature of mind. This is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor. I'm happy to be here with you so that together we can create a culture of wisdom, love, and beauty. Auspicious interbeing to you and yours, my friends, Koinos Hermes, and a deep bow of gratitude and reverence to Sophia and to the whole community of life. I want to say hello to some listeners out there, including some friends I've heard from recently in the U.S., Ireland, Canada, and Australia. Special hello to James in Tasmania. Good to hear from you. It's always nice to hear from listeners, even if you don't have any questions. But remember, you can always share your thoughts and questions through dangerouswisdom.org and do give us a review on Apple, Spotify, or Podchaser. It helps. Gets that wisdom out there. Well, here it is, friends. We finally get to the secret of entering the way of the wolf, the way of the wild, the way of the soul. If you missed parts 1 and 2, you might want to go back and start there. But we are on the cusp of deep spiritual teaching, so it's okay if you want to hit the ground running with the pack. Let's return to Dogen's words from our last contemplation. Dogen told us, quote, "We should understand that the mountains are not within the limits of the human realm or the limits of the heavens above. They are not to be viewed with the calculations of human thought." And Dogen also said, quote, "Although we say that mountains belong to the country, actually, they belong to those who love them. When the mountains love those they belong to, the wise and virtuous inevitably enter the mountains. And when sages and wise ones live in the mountains, because the mountains belong to them, trees and rocks flourish and abound, and the birds and beasts take on a supernatural excellence. This is because the sages and wise ones have covered them with their virtue. We should realize that the mountains actually take delight in wise ones, actually take delight in sages." Now that passage is loaded, really both of them are. And we are thinking about wolves and mountains, and we should understand that wolves are not within the realm of human calculation. They transcend our calculative thinking, just as mountains do. And I love how Dogen says that when sages and wise ones live in the mountains, because the mountains belong to them, trees and rocks flourish and abound. Not just trees, but trees and rocks. And the birds and the other beings, the wild ones, take on a supernatural excellence. And he doesn't mean anything woo-woo. He means what we've suggested before, that nature is super. There's a superness that's just part of what we are, and it's part of what we forsake under the sway of conquest consciousness. And when we think about those words of Dogen, we must think that mountains and wolves both remain beyond human calculation, and we must think the mountains love wolves, and the wolves love mountains. And that's what Aldo Leopold also invited us to think that. He invited us to learn the hidden meaning of the wolf and the mountain, the hidden meaning of our own life. Leopold told us we might learn the hidden meaning of our own life by listening to the howl of a wolf, and by learning to think like a mountain, which means learning to think like a wolf, learning to be like a wolf. We cannot live without the mountains, and so we cannot live without the wolves. But the mountains and wolves will not long endure if we do not learn to think as they think and live as they live. At least some wolves are sages and wise ones of the mountains. Some humans, too, like Larry Gibson, the man whose wise words we considered last time. Mountains delight in sages and wise ones, people like Wolf 21 and Larry Gibson. And the sages and wise ones, including wolves, but also including people like Dogen, Rumi, the Peacemaker, Maciej Glapdrun, Shabkar, we could mention many, many. Those kinds of sages can teach us how to become the delight of mountains and how to become the delight of all beings, how to cover the world in our virtue. We could delight each other instead of terrorizing one another, and we could vitalize each other rather than degrading ourselves, each other, in the community of life. And we can think of this as the gospel of mountains and wolves. Remember, gospel means good news, good words, good magic, the good spell, the gospel. The gospel of mountains and wolves is the good magic of mountains and wolves, the good magic of wisdom and wildness. That's the magic we need to rejuvenate ourselves and our world. There is a gospel of bee and flower, and of course, a gospel of horse and prairie. And these, too, are gospels of wisdom and wildness. But today we celebrate the gospel of mountain and wolf, or mountains and wolves. I would have called this little series on wolves the gospel of mountains and wolves, but I thought some Christian friends might consider it heretical, and non-Christians might have been put off by that phrase, and then no one would listen and think about these essential matters. In his book, The Philosopher and the Wolf, Mark Rowlands has a chapter called The Religion of the Wolf. Now, he's not a very religious guy, but that chapter offers a lot of good food for thought that can help us learn the gospel of mountains and wolves. To keep things feeling spacious and inclusive, let's speak of the love wisdom of wolf instead of calling it a religion. And let that love wisdom of wolf, or philosophy of wolf, encompass not only religion, but all philosophy and spirituality. In my interpretation of Rowlands' book, there are basically three core teachings of the love wisdom of wolf. First, being is time, but it isn't past, present, or future. Rather, being is moment. Secondly, our highest moments make us what we are, and no possession can replace their function in doing this. Finally, the most important or highest moments of our lives are the ones that force us to give up hope and fear and to somehow enter the inconceivable. Now, I've adjusted these teachings to put them slightly more in accord with the wisdom traditions as I understand them. Rowlands actually, I think, gets the wisdom traditions a little wrong in his discussion of this love wisdom of the wolf, but that doesn't take away from his book or the spirit of his message. Let's listen to what Rowlands has to say, and then we'll think about his words, or we'll link them up. We'll link some of it up to the teachings of the sages and wise ones. So first, a shorter passage regarding the first core teaching of the love wisdom of wolf, that being is time. Rowlands writes, quote, "A wolf is a creature of time as well as of the moment. It is just that we humans are more creatures of time and less creatures of the moment than is the wolf. We are better at looking through moments than the wolf, and the wolf is better at looking at moments than we are." This is a crucial idea. Okay, that's the quote. And we can recall Dogen here again when he wrote, quote, "We should understand that the mountains are not within the limits of the human realm or the limits of the heavens above. They are not to be viewed with the calculations of human thought. When Dogen wrote that, he was pointing us toward this same issue, but from a deep, deep place in the wisdom traditions, beyond the popular notion of the power of now. In practical terms, human beings, encumbered with domestication and conquest consciousness, take up a calculating approach to life. And that leads us to lose the moment and to instead entangle ourselves in hope and fear, extraction and exploitation, manipulation and control. It comes in a thousand varieties, a million varieties, and so often we can't see ourselves doing it. We think we're free of it. And that's why we talk about being in the moment even. I mean, it's just a catchphrase. And this is what Rollins is getting at, that seeing through the moment is the activity of extraction, exploitation, manipulation, and control. You're seeing through the moment on the basis of hope and fear. Or we could say fear and craving, it's the same. Now, following Gregory Bateson, we have referred to this as the problem of conscious human purpose. And we use that phrase to highlight that this orientation goes all together with our goals, our conscious intentions, our habitual sense of purpose, and our pervasive domestication, all of which makes it subtle and intimidating. And we've touched on it many times. I think how challenging that is to say that the problem is conscious human purpose. How do we face that? The dominant culture indoctrinates all of us with goal setting and intention setting. Doesn't matter if you're a hardcore business person or totally woo-woo. How do we face the fact that the wisdom traditions teach us that we humans just don't know how to intend very well? We have a video on YouTube about that. It's called The Most Important Thing for Spiritual and Ecological Sanity. There's a link in the transcript. And that video, or you can just look it up, The Most Important Thing for Spiritual and Ecological Sanity on YouTube. It's all about this issue. And it raises the challenges we face if we want to transcend domestication and conquest consciousness and find our way back to wisdom and wildness, compassion and creativity, beauty and grace. This issue is also a running theme in these episodes on ecological thinking, not just the ones about the wolf, but the others on ecological thinking too. And we'll have another episode focusing on it in the future. We'll touch on this crucial idea even a little bit further in this episode too. So it's just a major thing, not easy to wrestle with, easy to say platitudes about, not easy to face. But for now, let's move on to what Rollins says about the other two core teachings of the love wisdom of wolf. The second one is that our highest moments make us what we are, and the third is that those highest moments carry us beyond hope and fear and into the inconceivable. Now, this next excerpt from him is a little bit longer. I'll let you know when we come to the end of it. Here's what Rollins writes. The crucial point is that each of my highest moments is complete in itself, and does not require justification in the supposed role it plays in defining who and what I am. It is the moments that are important and not the person that they are erroneously supposed to reveal. That is the hard lesson. There are some moments, not all of them by any means, but there are some moments. And in the shadows of these moments, we will find out what is most important in our lives. These are our highest moments. I was at my best, I am convinced, when I was saying no to Brennan's death during those early days in France. I was a sleep-deprived shade of crazy. I thought I was dead and in hell. But nonetheless, these were among the highest moments of my life. This is what Sisyphus eventually understood. We are at our best when there is no point in going on when there is no hope for which to go on? But hope is a form of desire, and so it is what makes us temporal creatures, the arrows of our hope arcing off into the undiscovered country of our future. And sometimes it is necessary to put hope in its place, to put it back in its sleazy little box. And so we go on anyway. And in doing so, we make a point, although that, of course, is not why we do it. Any reason would undermine the point. To be at our best, we have to be pushed into a corner where there is no hope and nothing to be gained from going on. And we go on anyway. We are at our best when the 95-pound pit bull of life has us by the throat and pinned to the ground. Then we are just 3-month-old cubs and can be easily torn apart. There is pain coming, and we know it. And there is no hope. But we don't whine or yelp. We don't even struggle. Instead, there emanates from deep inside of us a growl that is calm and sonorous, that belies our tender age and existential fragility. Why am I here, after 4 billion years of blind and unthinking development the universe produced me? Was it worth it? I seriously doubt it. It's not my happy moments. It is these moments I now know that are my highest moments, because they are my most important moments. And they are important because of what they are in themselves, not because of any supposed role they play in defining who I am. If I am in any shape or form worth it, if I am a worthwhile thing for the universe to have done, then it is these moments that make me so. And so it was, I suppose, a wolf that revealed all this to me. He was the light, and I could see myself in the shadow he cast. What I learned was, in effect, the antithesis of religion. Religion always deals in hope. Hope is the used car salesman of human existence. So friendly, so plausible, but you cannot rely on him. What is most important in your life is the you that remains when your hope runs out. Anything we can have, anything we can possess, time will take it from us. But what time can never take from us is who we were in our best moments. And when it comes to remembering these moments, I never remember myself. I remember myself only through my memories of others. Here we are decisively confronted with the fallacy of egoism, the fundamental error of the human. What is important is not what we have, but who we were when we were at our best. And who we were when we were at our best is only revealed to us in moments, our highest moments. But our moments are never our own. Even when we are truly alone, when the pit bull has us pinned to the ground and we are but cubs and easily broken, it is the dog we remember and not ourselves. Our moments are most wonderful and our most terrifying moments. These become ours only through our memories of others, whether these others are good or evil. Our moments belong to the pack, and we remember ourselves through them. Okay, that's the excerpt. It was long, but I think it was worth it. And the first thing we need to clear up is that religion doesn't necessarily deal in hope. I appreciate what he's saying. Certainly, not all philosophies deal in hope. Buddhist philosophy explicitly invites us to transcend both hope and fear. And oddly enough, Rowlands accuses Buddhist philosophy in particular of offering hope, but that's mostly an error. When I teach meditation, for instance, it's heavily influenced by the Buddhist traditions, and I have to help people walk the razor's edge of letting go of hope while nevertheless applying all the passion they can muster. Letting go of hope is an explicit meditation instruction in a variety of traditions, including Buddhist traditions. It's also part of a lot of indigenous traditions. I've heard Chief Orrin Lyons mentioned that when some indigenous people, at least, speaking for the peoples that he knows and is familiar with, his tradition, that when they pray, they don't ask for things, they give thanks. So there's no hope there, no fear there. It's just a deep, deep appreciation of what we are, and an appreciation of the interwovenness in particular. I'm also reminded here of the great writer Nikos Kazantzakis, another Nikos. I'm Nikos Paradakis, and you can tell by that last name, if you know Greek last names, that we are from Crete. And Nikos Kazantzakis, the great writer, comes from the same place in Crete where my father was born, where my ancestors lived. And Kazantzakis asked his epitaph to have the following words in Greek: I hope for nothing, I fear nothing, I am free. His character, Zorba the Greek, lived a good bit of the love wisdom of Wolf. Hope and fear go together with domestication, while freedom goes together with wisdom and wildness. And Zorba had that quality of wisdom and wildness. Now, the reflection on memory that Rowlands offers is quite beautiful. He managed to touch the inconceivably wondrous nature of reality, which is interwovenness. And I think he explains it pretty well, but I was just thinking about it in relation to a first kiss, you know, because that seems like such an intimate and personal memory, but it only exists in relation to the person we kissed. Our first kiss may not be one of our highest moments, the way Rowlands describes it. In a certain sense, it could be. We could have a first kiss that transcends hope and fear. And in any case, it resembles all our highest moments because of that interwovenness. And in my case, I was thinking about how wild the interwovenness is, because that first kiss happened at an event when I was in high school, and it happened with a girl who went to another school. So I couldn't have had that first kiss except for everyone who organized that event. I had to have gone to the school I did, which happened in part because my grandfather, who was an alcoholic, went to a series of bars, struck up conversations with people there, and asked them about the public schools. He went all over the county, large area. And I didn't go to the best school in the county or the state, but he thought he had found as good a school as I was going to get, a public school in that part of the country, of the state. And of course, Tracy and I couldn't have had that first kiss without all the trees, grasses, and plankton that gave us air to breathe. We could go on and on. And I understand that he's talking about just that immediate recognition that there was this other there. Someone else was there, but everything was there. Everything was there. Every kiss arises as part of the inconceivable interwovenness that is our cosmos. how we love each other belongs to the whole of nature. Our love doesn't just belong to us. It belongs to the whole of nature. It will affect the whole of nature. It is the memory and magic of nature. The world thrives on the basis of our moments. And that's why Dogen said that mountains belong to those who love them. We arise interwoven with mountains and wolves, with horses and prairies, with dolphins and oceans, with birds and trees, bees and flowers. That interwovenness produces magic of all kinds, and Roland's got a taste of that magic. It's not really a spoiler alert to let you know that Brennan dies in the book. Wolves don't live that long, and the subtitle of the book mentions death. The book also opens pretty close to his death. It's fairly close to the beginning, if I recall. Now, you have to read the book to find out how he died and to find out more about how he lived. But here's what Roland says happens after Brennan died. I'll let you know when we get to the end of this excerpt. Here's what he writes. I couldn't bury him in the garden. The owners of the house would almost certainly have taken exception to that. So I buried him at a place where we stopped every day on our walks, a small clearing surrounded by beech trees and scrub oak. The ground was sandy, and it didn't take me long to dig a substantial hole. When I had put Brennan in the ground, I built over his grave a cairn made from rocks I carried across from the dike that prevented the winter storm surges from sweeping up into the village. This was a long and arduous process, as the dike was a couple of hundred yards away, and it took me well into the night to finish the job. Then I lit a driftwood bonfire and decided to sit with my brother through the rest of the night. This is the part of the story that I am reluctant to tell, since, once again, I come across as completely psychotic, which I no doubt was. Keeping me company were the two dogs, Nina and Tess, and 2 liters of Jack Daniels, which I had stockpiled, knowing that this night was coming soon. I had been dry for the past few weeks, since I needed to keep my mind clear to make the best decisions I could for Brennan. I couldn't afford to have any alcohol-induced melancholy make me send him on his way a moment before his time, nor could I allow any alcohol-induced euphoria to force him to cling to this life when it was not worth living. By the time I was significantly into my second liter, what had started out as a quiet rumination about the possibility of an afterlife had transformed into a raging torrent of invective directed against God. It went something like this. You show me. If we live on, you effer, show me now. The next bit sounds horrendously far-fetched, but I swear to God it's true. At the very moment I said this, I looked across the fire and saw him. I saw Brennan's ghost of stone. I want to emphasize just how inexplicable this is. When I made the cairn, I traveled up and down the dike, picking up rocks wherever I found them, detached or loose. Then I carried them back a couple of hundred yards or so to the clearing. When I got there, I simply dropped them on Brennan's grave. I repeated this many, many times, and the entire process took around 5 hours. The dropping of the rocks on the grave was an entirely random process. I am still convinced of this. I did not place the stones. I just dropped them. I had no overall vision of the completed cairn driving me on. On the contrary, I just wanted it finished, and I wanted to get astonishingly drunk. But now, there, staring back at me through the flames, was Brennan's ghost of stone. The front of the cairn was his head, a diamond-shaped slab of rock, snout resting, as was his fashion, on the ground, and with a stain of moss on the sharp end that looked, for all the world, like his nose. The rest of the cairn was a wolf curled up as if in the snow, a habit inculcated in Brennan by his Arctic forebears, and which he found difficult to break even in the heat of an Alabama or Languedoc summer. There, at the zenith of my rage and need, he stared back at me. Okay, that's the excerpt. Now, he had a lot more swearing in there. I kind of deleted some of that out. And I also realized that he confesses that he wanted to get astonishingly drunk. And you might think, oh, he was just hallucinating. But no, when he woke up the next morning and he was really out of it, he passed out there. And then he woke up the next morning, the wolf was still there. And he visited that wolf every day when he walked past with the dogs. It was still there. He had somehow, some way, inexplicably, even though he was dropping these rocks randomly from a dike, he was carrying them a couple hundred yards and just letting them fall as gravity took them. Still, somehow or other, he made this statue of Brennan, looked like Brennan. So we'll let that magic rest there. Now let's return to time, because we're going to try to get clear on something. What we will consider here, in all seriousness, is that the way of the wolf involves at least one central and essential practice if we want to enter into the mystery of the wolf and really learn how to think like wolves and think like mountains. We've got to have something essential. Now, remember what Roland said about time. He said, wolves, for the most part, experience time differently than humans do. He spoke about seeing the moment in the case of the wolf and missing the moment to see through it in the case of the human. Roland was trained as an academic philosopher in the dominant culture, so I don't expect him to know that the wisdom traditions have long spoken of this important difference as part of what separates ignorant people from sages. And we have consistently raised this suggestion, and with each contemplation in the series on ecological thinking, also in the series we've done on magic, we get clearer and clearer about the non-duality of wisdom and wildness. And we get clearer and clearer about philosophy as a path of transcending our domestication, a path of rewilding ourselves and healing self and world, reunifying nature and culture. That's key, especially if you think what I'm talking about is running around wearing animal pelts and hunting with spears. We just have to break down this duality. I think we can have what we refer to as civilization just needs to be rejuvenated, altered. We'll get to that. But it's ironic that Rawlins joined a discipline that had changed in terribly unfortunate ways in the process of the development of the dominant culture and the development of conquest consciousness within that set of cultures that we refer to collectively as the dominant culture. I mean, you know, it's not one thing, it's not monolithic, but there is a style of consciousness, I think, that kind of pervades that set of cultures. So Rawlins became a philosopher only to have a wolf appear as his most significant teacher of real philosophy. And remember, we're making that old distinction, just like Thoreau did, not that long ago, between professors of philosophy, academic philosophy, and philosophy as a way of life, and real philosophers. Philosophy itself offers us the most accessible path to thinking like wolf does. And thus learning the lessons Brennan tried to teach Mark Rowlands. All of us affected by the dominant culture, all of us infected by conquest consciousness, need to learn these lessons, it seems that way. So let's turn to a great philosopher, Dogen, and let him invite us into some reflections on time. Dogen wrote a famously challenging essay. Well, many of his essays are famously... Dogen's just not easy. He's not the kind of philosopher you just pick up and read. But one of his challenging essays is called Being Time, Uji. And it goes well beyond the reflections of time offered by Rowlands. Again, I don't expect Rowlands to know about these sorts of teachings, but they can help us enter the way of the wolf. And they can help us realize the wisdom and wildness indigenous to our soul and indigenous to the world we share, just as it's indigenous to the wolf's soul. In this essay, Dogen writes, quote, "Time itself is being, and all being is time," end quote. Now, in some ways, that's like saying the world is process and dynamism, which is more subtle than it sounds. It's easy to say that. Oh, everything's process. Everything's in motion. It's more subtle. And I'd like to read you a longer excerpt. But here's the thing. Dogen is not easy. Trust yourself and trust that your soul will understand more of this than your intellect will. And your intellect may space out. Your eyes may get foggy. You may get bored. You may say, this is ridiculous. I don't even know what he's talking about anymore. But it's very intimate. That's the only reason it seems confusing. Dogen is one of the most intimate philosophers. Very, very profound. And I promise some of it will make sense, and we will try to unpack a little bit of it. But just stay with it and let your heart listen. Just imagine, oh, hey, I don't need to understand all this consciously. That's not even what I am. I'm not just what I think I am consciously. Dogen himself is going to present you a moment beyond hope. You may say there's no hope in understanding this. It's okay. Now I'm going to read this and let you know when we get to the end. So here's what Dogen writes, and it's just an excerpt. He writes, "The way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world. See each thing in this entire world as a moment of time. Things do not hinder one another, just as moments do not hinder one another. The way-seeking mind arises in this moment. A way-seeking moment arises in this mind. It is the same with practice and with attaining the way. Thus, the self setting itself out in array sees itself. This is the understanding that the self is time. Each moment is all being. Each moment is the entire world. Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. Do not think that time merely flies away. Do not see flying away as the only function of time. If time merely flies away, you would be separated from time. The reason you do not clearly understand being time is that you think of time only as passing. In essence, all things in the entire world are linked with one another as moments. Because all moments are being time, they are your being time. Being time is entirely actualized without being caught up in nets or cages. The being time of all beings throughout the world, in water and on land, actualizes your complete effort right now. All beings of all kinds in the visible and invisible realms are the being time actualized by your complete effort, flowing due to your complete effort. Closely examine this flowing. Without your complete effort right now, nothing would be actualized. Nothing would flow. Okay, that's the excerpt. And there might have been some moments in there where you thought, what is going on? It's a lovely set of images that Dogen gives us, especially at the end, I think. The ideas there resonate with the lesson the wolves taught us about cages, and they resonate so profoundly with what Roland said about our moments. He said our moments belong to the pack, and we remember ourselves through them. And Dogen, of course, goes well beyond that. Dogen teaches this very same interwovenness of all things, the interwovenness of mind and nature that characterizes Yeats's definition of magic as well. Our series on magic overlaps completely with this series on ecological thinking. And Dogen unites our moments with the whole cosmos. He tells us that the way we face each moment belongs to all beings, and our complete effort actualizes the whole world, moment to moment. This world happens, this world flows, because of you, and vice versa. That's a beautiful thing, that we can face that moment beyond hope and fear. The reason we can go on is that the effort of all the other beings actualizes us at that moment too. You see, that memory that Rollins was talking about, he doesn't really spell this out. Brennan made that moment for him as much as he did. Sure, it was beyond hope and fear, but he didn't actualize that all by himself, so that also takes away the egoism. And maybe he meant that when he was trying to deflate our egotism, but we're spelling it out now. So this way of magic and actualization fundamentally involves something important that I think is in some ways a key to entering the way of the wolf. This way of magic and actualization that Dogen spells out, it gives us an invitation. I mean, Dogen is saying, here's the entry to the way of the wolf, the way of the wildness, the way of the horse. Whatever your spirit being is, whatever your love is, this way to love. And central to that path is meditation. Meditation is the practice and realization of the mind of the wolf. Meditation is the practice and realization of the gospel of mountains and wolves, the gospel of horses and prairies, the gospel of birds and trees. Whatever your gospel is, your good news, your good magic, meditation can help you. If we want the most direct entrance into the way of the wolf, or whatever way we want to follow, meditation is it. Holistically practiced, though. It can't be isolated. The holism means we need education and instruction. We need a holistic approach. It's not another tool in the toolkit. So with that caveat that we have to have it as something integrated, let's consider some general reflections on Dzogchen meditation. That's a meditation style in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And these reflections come from Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And it's a little bit longer. I'll let you know when we get to the end of it. But notice that this excerpt explicitly mentions time, and it presents us with the sensibility of the highest moments that Rollins tried to describe, without needing those moments to be particularly harsh, Because Rollins kind of leaves us with this Navy SEAL version that we have to be at some crazy extreme. And the wisdom traditions say that's not really necessary. We have to have big passion. And we'll get to that a little bit too. But we can get beyond hope and fear right where we stand. We don't have to wait for some kind of catastrophe or extreme life situation to enter the wisdom and wildness of the way of the wolf. And Trungpa Rinpoche presents us with the very spirit of the wolf, I think, which sees the fundamental equality of each being, each moment, each situation, without covering over their utter uniqueness. And he offers us a way into wisdom and wildness. So let's savor, if we can, what Trungpa has to teach. He's a lot more accessible on the surface than Dogen, but every bit is profound underneath. So that anytime these profound sages feel very accessible on the surface, that's wonderful, and at the same time, it means we have to really remind ourselves that we don't understand it just because the words seem easier. They seem like an easier access than Dogen. So Dogen is just very deliberate about trying to cut the intellect off in a relative sense, you know, to try to stop us from grasping and closing down on with our cages, you know. He's always saying, this is not going to fit in your cages. This is how you get out of your cage. And Trungpa has that same spirit. And I'm just saying that, hey, maybe some of this will sound friendly and accessible, but he's still coming from a profound place. So here's Trungpa, and I'll let you know when we get to the end. He writes, all aspects of every phenomenon are completely clear and lucid. The whole universe is open and unobstructed. Everything mutually interpenetrating. The everyday practice of meditation is simply to develop a complete acceptance and openness to all situations and emotions and to all people, experiencing everything totally without mental reservations and blockages, so that one never withdraws or centralizes onto oneself. This produces a tremendous energy, which is usually locked up in the processes of mental evasion and generally running away from life experiences. Clarity of awareness may, in its initial stages, be unpleasant or fear-inspiring. All phenomena naturally appear in their uniquely correct modes and situations, forming ever-changing patterns full of meaning and significance, like participants in a great dance. Everything is symbol, yet there is no difference between the symbol and the truth symbolized. One should not sit down to meditate with various hopes and fears about the outcome. One just does it, with no self-conscious feeling of, I am meditating. All phenomena are completely new and fresh, absolutely unique at the instant of their appearance, and entirely free from all concepts of past, present, and future, as if experienced in another dimension of time. The continual stream of new discovery and fresh revelation and inspiration which arises at every moment is the manifestation of the eternal youth of the living Dharma, and its wonder, splendor, and spontaneity are the play or dance aspect of the universe as teacher. Learn to see everyday life as a mandala in which one is at the center, and be free of the bias and prejudice of past conditioning, past desires, and future hopes and expectations. The figures of the mandala are the day-to-day objects of one's life experience, moving in the great dance or play of the universe, the symbolism by which the teacher reveals profound and ultimate meaning and significance. Therefore, be natural and spontaneous. Accept and learn from everything. see the ironic, amusing side of irritating situations. In meditation, see through the illusion of past, present, and future. The past is but a present memory or condition, the future a present projection, and the present itself vanishes before it can be grasped. Free oneself from past memories of and conceptions about meditation. Each moment of meditation is completely unique and full of the potentiality of new discovery. So one is incapable of judging meditation by past sessions or by theory. Just plunge straight into meditation at this very moment with one's whole mind and be free from hesitation, boredom, or excitement. Now that's Trungpa, and we find these ideas throughout Buddhist philosophy. In his Heart Jewel of the Fortunate, the great sage Dzogchen Rinpoche said, quote, "If you do not meditate, you will not gain certainty. If you do meditate, you will gain certainty. But what sort of certainty? If you meditate with a strong, joyful endeavor, signs will appear showing that you have become used to staying in your nature. The aggressive, tight clinging that you have to dualistically experienced phenomena will gradually loosen up, and your obsession with happiness and suffering, hopes and fears and so on, will slowly weaken. After a time, your tense, dualistic attitudes will evaporate. As the great teacher has said, my view is higher than the sky, but my attention to actions and their results is finer than flower." So don't go around claiming to be some great Dzogchen meditator when in fact you are nothing but a farting lout. That's the end of the passage. Pretty funny line for a famous sage. We see in these teachings that we can enter a different experience of time, really just a different experience of life. That we can enter our highest moments and we can go beyond hope and fear right here. Don't have to have a particular 95-pound pit bull of life sitting on us. It's always there. We meet that in meditation, without having to go to extremes. That's what Buddha taught us, sitting just peacefully under that tree. And we do need to do this for both spiritual and ecological reasons, enter into this kind of holistic practice in one way or another. Getting beyond hope and fear means getting beyond our credulity and our distraction. We've returned several times to something Rowlands wrote in this regard. He wrote, quote, "If I wanted a one-sentence definition of human beings, this would do. Humans are the animals that believe the stories they tell about themselves. Humans are credulous animals." And he continues, "In these dark times, it does not need emphasizing that the stories we tell about ourselves can be the biggest source of division between one human and another. From credulity, there is often but a short step to hostility. However, I am concerned with the stories we tell to distinguish ourselves not from each other, but from other animals. The stories we tell about what makes us human," end quote. That's very loaded because it really touches on the notion of vision and intention that we find in wisdom traditions. Can't live without vision, and we've got bad vision. And we're suggesting here that only when we meditate do we find out the fuller truth to which Rowlands gestures here. And I would say he doesn't give us a full enough picture, even in a thumbnail sketch, because he's missing half of the caricature. Our stories, first of all, cut us off from ourselves just as much as they cut us off from each other and from nature. So that's important. They are wrecking our vision. Our stories cut us off from our potential and from the wondrous potentials latent and implicit in our world. And when we meditate, we find the other part of the story too. We discover that credulity and distraction are suffering. That is a simple definition of suffering, and that would do. He says, if I wanted a one-sentence definition of human beings, and I think it is human beings caught in suffering. And I would reply, well, if I wanted that, I would say we need to add distraction. Suffering is credulity and distraction together, really. They arise together. We begin to truly realize their relationship to suffering and to our habitual compulsive experience of life when we meditate. When we meditate, if we look with passion, we can notice how we believe all the stories, memories, thoughts, and notions that pop into our mind. We believe them, and we follow along with them, elaborating them endlessly. And that goes together with an inability to rest the mind, to have the mind simply abide in peace. We sit down to meditate, perhaps with the intention to stay with our breathing, as one example. And almost instantly a thought, memory, emotion, hope, or fear comes along, and we leave the breathing, and we follow our hopes and fears. We do this because distraction and credulity go together. When we meditate, we can thus find out how much credulity and distraction drive our whole experience of life, how they make the world. We're making the world out of credulity and distraction. And this includes a deep, deep credulity. Not just a credulity that an election was stolen or a credulity that we have democracy, but a deep credulity about what we are, what wolves are, what nature is, what other humans are, what the world we share is, what the cosmos itself is. That kind of credulity is not easy to shake. And you think about all of it. The beliefs we have about other people, other races, other cultures, other skin colors, other genders, all these beliefs, also about ourselves. It's an active credulity. It applies to our very construction of reality. And it applies to countless stories about ourselves, other beings in the world we share. The credulity applies to our sense of I can't. People tell me all the time that they can't meditate, that they can't change this or that habit, and so on. We have many such impossibilities in our culture about ourselves, each other, and the world we share, such as the impossibility of having real democracy, including real democracy in our work. We have big credulity and big distraction. The dominant culture functions fully on the basis of distraction and credulity, and all our suffering connects with this distraction and credulity. Wolves teach us to practice non-distraction and doubt, real doubt. That's not ordinary doubt. This doubt has to have some passion. It has to be organized, not disorganized. The Zen tradition refers to this as great doubt. The Buddha spoke about it as Dhammavikaya, which means way-seeking mind, a mind of wonder, a mind of passionate inquiry. In Zen, we find the phrase, small doubt, small awakening, great doubt, great awakening. And that kind of mind gets applied especially to meditation, and especially in some traditions, to cases of spiritual common law. Now, Zen has a wolf-like spirit in some ways, a spirit of passionate never giving up, a spirit of resilience and joyful perseverance. And we find that spirit in many traditions. It's not exclusive to Zen, but Zen emphasizes it in a particularly nice way. It's like Zen wears it on its sleeve, you could say. And it appears in many cases of spiritual common law that we find in the Zen traditions. And just as we have political common law, I've talked about this before, those of you who know what this is, that's fine, but for if you haven't heard that phrase, we have political common law. You know, that's where justice gets expressed by means of the wisdom of a good judge and without the need for a legal statute. Otherwise, you have statutory law. A legislative body passes a law, that's law. Common law isn't that way. It comes from jurisprudence. We also have spiritual common law in which wisdom itself gets expressed directly, as opposed to in some formal written teaching or oral teaching. It's just, there it is, it happened in a moment. In some vitalizing encounter, often between human beings, but not strictly so. So spiritual common law is the common law of moment and action. And you see this in a lot of Zen masters. One Zen master, Joshu, he had a particularly wolf-like spirit, and I can give you a few examples of some moments he had. In one case, a student asked him, "What is holy?" And Joshu said, "Not ordinary." The student said, "Well, what is ordinary?" Joshu said, "Not holy." The student said, "What about when there is neither ordinary nor holy?" And Joshu said, "That is a good Zen monk." Now we could add that makes for a good wolf, too. In another exchange, a student asked, "What is the teacher of the seven Buddhas?" And Joshu said, "Sleeping when it's time to sleep, waking when it's time to wake." That is a pretty intimate wolf teaching, too. But the most famous exchange with Joshu, famous case of spiritual common law, philosophy of moment, it went something like this. The student asked, "Does a wolf have Buddha nature?" Joshu said, "No." And when Joshu said that no, I think we can imagine it like a bark, no, or a growl, no. Maybe even a howl. I won't try howling out that no for you. Now, technically, the student asked if dogs have Buddha nature, but the spirit of both the question and the answer remained the same, no. Cases of spiritual common law require not just understanding, but wonderstanding. And that means going beyond intellectual notions. However, it doesn't hurt to get the intellectual notions out of the way so we can acknowledge them. They can be important, while also acknowledging that they don't give the full answer to such a case. Intellectually, this case in part has to do with a basic teaching of Buddhist philosophy that all beings have Buddha nature, all beings, no exceptions. So why did Joshu say wolves or dogs don't have Buddha nature? Because wolves don't focus on having. They instead focus on being. Being moment, being time. We actually find the same idea in the Earth Charter, a marvelous civil society document that invites us to practice our human cultures in such a way that we can all focus on being more rather than having more. It says that in the Earth Charter. We find the same idea in the movie Lucy, too, which is, I enjoy that movie for pop culture, sort of sci-fi kind of flick. In that movie, the character played by Morgan Freeman speaks of a shift from having more to being more. That's what he says is holding human beings back. We're stuck on having rather than being. And he speaks of this in relation to going beyond our limitations, getting out of our cages. The cage is having. Morgan Freeman's character muses on this as part of imagining the realization of our fullest capacities for intelligence. The lead character in that film, she's named Lucy, of course. She's played by Scarlett Johansson. And Lucy understands. Her intellect gets released. Her intelligence is just opened up. And she understands that our habitual experience of hope and fear, pleasure and pain, and the whole process of identification, all of that keeps us caged. She understands that ignorance is the problem. The film is not a perfect work of philosophy, but it does put forward some ideas that resonate with the wisdom traditions, including the suggestion that something primordial lies underneath all our habitual patterns, something that can never actually be caged, something not separate from being time. And the movie suggests that our highest calling in life is to learn the true nature of what we are and what the cosmos is, and to share what we learn with others. To do that, we have to be willing to risk our own teeth, as Lucy herself ends up having to do. In the Buddhist traditions, a Buddha is someone with fully activated intelligence. They've activated capacities most of us don't even know we have. So it's somewhat akin to the character of Lucy. I wouldn't say she's a Buddha, but there's something really resonant in the two images. The Tibetan traditions teach that when we die, even if we don't become a Buddha through the process of death, which we can do, but even if we just go into the death realm and go into the bardo of dying and in the bardo of the between, we are 9 times more intelligent when we leave our body just because of all the limitations we carry around as part of our embodiment. It seems we could suggest that ketamine works for a similar reason, and momentarily releases people from the body, and they can sometimes achieve insight by dropping all that embodied ignorance away. Now, that doesn't mean we have to hate our bodies or that we're not embodied beings, nothing like that. The point just has to do with our fuller potential and how we need to let go of having, always trying to have more. That having orientation in general, we need to let go of that in order to realize that fuller potential, or at least to taste it. And we have to understand that our bodies sometimes collaborate with all the triggers to have more. This idea of being more instead of having more is not original to the Earth Charter or to the movie Lucy, but rather appears in the wisdom traditions of the world going back centuries, going back millennia, really. Socrates evoked this sentiment at his trial. It was part of his life. He was put to death for trying to educate the youth, to educate them about becoming more, about following the path of wisdom, love, and beauty so that they could be more, so that any of us following that path could be more rather than staying trapped in the cage of trying to have more. His culture saw this as heresy. The dominant culture still sees it that way. So the main currents of our culture drive us in a million ways to seek having more. And that often comes with the rationalization that this, in turn, will allow us to be more. You see that all over in the life coaching space and a lot of New Agey kinds of thoughts. We're just rationalizing the game. It's a lie. And we are all pretty credulous about this. We're stuck with it right now until we can try to think a little more like Wolf. Learn the gospel of mountains and wolves, horses and prairies, bees and flowers, birds and forests. Now, all of this can remain intellectual. It's so easy. A student also asked Joshu, "What about when I don't have anything?" And the master said, "Throw it away." I love that. That's part of the spirit of Wolf, too. We try to cling even to the antidotes. But clinging is part of credulity and distraction. We get caught in so many different ways. I see this throughout the wisdom traditions, and I get to see it as a consulting philosopher with clients all the time. We just grasp and then grasp and then grasp over here, and we seem to let go of the thing, but we didn't yet. Or we let go of it and very quickly grasp onto something else. The grasping is amazing, astounding. Our distraction and credulity, it's the whole of the Dangerous Wisdom curriculum in a way. That's all it's about. But it gives that education that we need, that holistic education. You find it in the wisdom traditions. Now, we said that we've dealt with these spiritual common law examples in an intellectual way, in order to really work with spiritual common law, in order to enter into wonderstanding and escape from our cages, we need to practice real meditation. And so I'm encouraging you, find some instruction. We need real instruction, interaction with teachers and friends. But we'll say a little bit about it because of, I think, how some meditation instructions, like we already heard from Trungpa, some meditation instructions really put you in touch with the spirit of wolf. And I was thinking about the Korean Zen master Kusan. He gives us some powerful instructions for meditation. First of all, his name means nine mountains, so we can receive his instructions as part of the gospel of mountains and wolves. And I want to say a couple of things ahead of time about it. One is that this really is that spirit of fierceness. And we shouldn't think that all meditation has to be as fierce as he describes it, but it needs to have that passion even if we sort of transmute it into a gentleness. Dogen, who was pretty fierce too, he described meditation as entering the gate of ease and joy. That's what Buddha taught, a path of joy, but we really have to have the passion. There's a way in which that fierceness, where we turn the meditation experience into moment, the way Rollins was trying to touch on, so it's subtle. It seems very important for so many people in the dominant culture just to kind of relax a little bit. We're too wound up, but we can't lose the passion. Now, second thing to know about this. So, in other words, just don't be intimidated. Know that he's really calling for a lot of passion, and that is important, however we get to it. The other thing is that when he dealt with spiritual common law, he focused on one question, and that is, what is this? It's very similar to Ramana Maharshi's query. This is an old thing. Some people who know about Maharshi, they think he's the only person who meditated that way, and it's just not true. It's old. It's been in the Buddhist tradition to meditate the way he taught for a long time. Nisargadatta, I think, also, that was his question in a way, just a very similar one. Maharshi kind of changed it a little bit into, who am I? And for Kusan, it was, what is this? And that was about everything, you know, just what is listening to me right now? When you're sitting there listening to this podcast, what is hearing it? What produces the thinking about it? So that was what he did. Instead of having, in some traditions, in the Zen schools and the Zen streams, you find a whole curriculum of spiritual common law. And spiritual common law cases exist anyway, and even in the Korean tradition, even if you focused on just this one question, there still is a bunch of other spiritual common law that you would be introduced to, because there's just this importance of presencing the moment. It's a very Zen thing. But he's going to focus, Kusan, Master Nine Mountains. Nine Mountains is going to focus on that question. So those are the things to keep in mind. Don't freak out when he really gets into that wolf spirit of fierceness. And know that wolves can play, and Zen masters can play too, even very serious ones. And know that this is not the only way to think about meditation, but it's very important to just recognize the value of passionate inquiry. So here's what Nine Mountains said to a group of his students, and I'll let you know when we get to the end. It is most important to continuously investigate the question of spiritual common law with unswerving determination. At the beginning, you might feel as though you are trying to lift a heavy bucket full of water with a weak arm. Even so, you should never relax your effort. Instead, no matter what you are doing, be solely concerned with nothing but the question. If a clock were unreliable and kept stopping, any sensible person would either have it repaired or get rid of it. Similarly, when practicing meditation, you must exert continuous effort and not allow yourself to be lazy. In Zen meditation, the key factor is to maintain a constant sense of questioning. So, having taken hold of the spiritual common law question, what is this? Try to always sustain the questioning. What is seeing? What is hearing? What is moving these hands and feet, and so on? Before the initial sense of questioning fades, it is important to give rise to the question again. In this way, the process of questioning can continue uninterrupted with each new question overlapping the previous one. In addition, you should try to make this overlapping smooth and regular. But this does not mean you should just mechanically repeat the question as though it were a mantra. It is useless to just say to yourself day and night, what is this, what is this? The key is to sustain the sense of questioning, not the repetition of words. Once this inquiry gets underway, there will be no room for boredom. If the mind remains quiet, the spiritual inquiry will not be forgotten, and the sense of questioning will continue unbroken. In this way, awakening will be easy. While meditating, both wisdom and concentration need to be cultivated in unison. If there is wisdom without concentration, then mistaken views will increase. And if there is concentration without wisdom, then ignorance will grow. Now, those were the instructions of Nine Mountains, the Korean Zen Master Kusan. Now, he also said something else that is worth considering. Here's what he said at another time. He said, in practicing meditation, you should be prepared to grab hold of the blade of a sword so sharp that it cuts through hairs merely blown against it. You would normally be apprehensive even to take hold of such a sword by its handle, since at the slightest slip, you would be in danger of cutting yourself. Now, you have to be prepared to seize it by the blade. Could you possibly do that in your ordinary frame of mind? As long as you are afraid of the sharpness of the blade, you are bound to cut yourself. But in firmly gripping the blade with an utterly intrepid mind, you will not even be scratched. Okay, now that's intense. It's intense, but it speaks about this energy of entering the moment, this energy of entering the inconceivable, getting beyond hope and fear. You know, when we say there's no point in going on, and we do it anyway. And it speaks to the indigenous saying Gary Snyder quotes in his wonderful work of love wisdom called The Practice of the Wild. I've recommended that a bunch of times. Read it, then write me an email, because I know you're going to enjoy it, so you can tell me how glad you are you finally listened to me. Now there, Snyder quotes the saying, it's an indigenous saying, the world is as sharp as the edge of a knife. And we need a Zen mind, a wolf mind, just a mind of love wisdom. It doesn't have to be so Zen mastery, you know what I mean? But still that fierceness that is not aggressive, but is just, it won't let itself be defeated. It's a never give up mind. That's the mind we need to walk that razor's edge and to preserve what we call civilization. And we're in a predicament there. You see, it's so interesting. This is the reason why I love this passage, is there's this other layer in it, you know? It's part of the mandala. Because Kusan, Master Nine Mountains, he says you'd be afraid. Think of your ordinary mind. Are you really going to grab a blade that sharp? No. But if we sense something in us, the ego knows this world is as sharp as a knife. So we won't embrace this world. That's why we're destroying it. And Kusan is saying, just let yourself be the wolf you are. Be the wild Mustang you are. Be the wild redwood you are. Be the wild hummingbird you are. And you'll embrace that knife and you won't get cut. It's that. Our ordinary mind just won't embrace the world because we sense it as sharp as a knife. And we have to let go of that mind, get out of that cage. And this is how Snyder puts this predicament. He writes, Thoreau says, give me a wildness no civilization can endure. That's clearly not difficult to find. It is harder to imagine a civilization that wildness can endure. Yet this is just what we must try to do. Wildness is not just the preservation of the world. It is the world. Civilizations east and west have long been on a collision course with wild nature, and now the developed nations in particular have the witless power to destroy not only individual creatures, but whole species, whole processes of the earth. We need a civilization that can live fully and creatively together with wildness. We must start growing it right here in the new world. That's Gary Snyder, and by that he means right here on Turtle Island, or what we usually call North America, but it's a global issue. The Earth Charter has to do with this issue too. And if he's right, look at how that thread runs through the mandala. It's like a luminous thread in a luminous tapestry. Wildness is the world, says Gary Snyder. What does Dogen say? The world is moment. What does Rowlands tell us? Moment is wolf mind. We're just getting at the same thing. We have to follow, embrace these gospels of mountains and rivers, birds and forests, horses and prairies. Our practice of life is reflected in the land. They arise together. That's what Dogen was telling us. Our practice makes all the other beings. Their practice makes us. And so our practice of life, that includes our practice of mind. Whether or not we practice meditation, that's why we need to practice meditation. Our virtues appear in the land, and so do our vices. Our clarity, stability, peace, and clear knowing appear in the land and in all beings, in their bodies, in our bodies. And so do our incoherence, our discoordination, our distractedness, our fear and craving, our self-doubt and self-loathing, that appears in the land and in all beings, in our children, in other people's children. If we think about the world today, if we look at it, we can see our practice of life vividly reflected in all lands, all of them. If we cannot find ourselves here now, when do we think we will find ourselves? When will we do it? Dogen gives us the basic instructions. Now, we need personal direct teaching. I want to say that. We need a community. We need teachers. We need good teachings. But still, Dogen gives us the basics, and here's what he says. Once you have regulated your posture, take a breath and exhale fully. Sitting fixedly, think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This is the essential art of proper meditation. Proper meditation is not the practice of meditation as people typically think of it. It is just the reality gate of ease and joy. It is the practice and verification of ultimate awakeness, the fundamental point of wisdom realized. Baskets and cages cannot get to it. So there we have it again. To enter into non-thinking is to enter the way of wolf, the way of horse, the way of mountains and rivers. To enter non-thinking means getting free from our cages, getting free from the matrix, free from domestication and conquest, free from manipulation and control. It means unleashing our fullest creative intelligence, the creative intelligence we need to rejuvenate ourselves, our civilization, and the whole community of life. We can't accomplish a graceful and vitalizing civilization if we can't live together with wolves and with mountains and with horses. We have gotten domesticated out of our connection with wolves and domesticated out of our connection with the wildness that is indigenous to our own soul and the soul of the world. That domestication is our cage. It is our modern matrix. And it's sucking the life out of all of us, including all our kin, human and more than human. As we said before, for the world to evolve, we must cultivate those qualities of mind its evolution depends on. We must cultivate those qualities of heart, mind, body, and world that its evolution depends on. We have to cultivate the superness of nature and verify our own superness and our own naturalness. We do that by means of a holistic practice of life, which includes meditation. That's right. Got to do it. Find a way. Find a style and a lineage that works for you and learn it in the context of a holistic education, not by itself, not as another tool in our toolbox, not as a big challenge to the ego when we go on some 10-day retreat, but as something truly holistic and revolutionary. Now, we need to go further into all of these matters to understand the way to shift our minds, to rewild our hearts and minds and bodies and world without falling into chaos or further insanity. Now, for now, we've definitely earned a break. I appreciate that you've come this far. This is one of those intimidating episodes that's longer than an hour, so thank you for your courage in facing all this with me. I hope it's been as joyful for you as it has been for me. I feel so inspired when I read Dogen, and Trungpa can be so wise and inspiring. All these great teachers. And reading about the wolves is so inspiring because they presence this wondrous mind that we two share. It's the same nature of mind. Got the same nature of mind. Our minds differ, but the nature of that mind is the same. So please contemplate all these things deeply, and if you have questions or stories to share, anything, just send it in through dangerouswisdom.org. We might be able to bring some of it into a future contemplation. Until then, this is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, reminding you that your soul and the soul of the world are not two things. If you take good care, it will take good care in return.